नेक्स्ट टॉपिक द सवालियर पोएट, CAVALIER पोएट्स. इंट्रोडक्शन. इन द कोरलाइन पीरियड, द एज ऑफ चार्ल्स फर्स्ट 1625 टू 49, देयर वॉज अ रिमार्केबल आउटब्रस्ट ऑफ लिरिकल एक्टिविटी. मोस्ट ऑफ द लिरिकिस्ट विद द वेरी नोटेबल एक्सेप्शन ऑफ हेरिक वेयर कोर्टियर्स ऑन अकाउंट ऑफ देयर लीनिंग टुवार्ड द किंग एंड द कोर्ट पार्टी एज अगेंस्ट द प्यूरिटन ऑफ राउंड हेड्स. These lyricists come courtier have come to be classed in the history of English literature as chevalier poet or chevalier lyricists. However, it may be pointed out that they did not use their muse as a tool of propaganda, political and or religious. They kept their royalism away and apart from their poetic activity. Among the chevalier poet may also be mentioned the name of Falkland, Mann, Sleveland, Hobbington, May, Randolph, and many more also. However, here our purpose is to deal with only the more important one. These are Herrick, Crewe, Skilling, and Lawless. Some common features. The output of the chevalier poets falls in a class on account of certain qualities which may be disconcerned. Though in varying degrees in the work of each on of them, but it may be pointed out that it is only the minor chevalier poets who are merely representative with comparatively less well-defined individualities of their own. Every one of the four major chevalier poets named above has his own individual approach and flavor, and that is the reason why he is a major poet. At this year, some characteristics. For instance, they all wrote very short poems. Very few of them comprising above 100 words. Further, even though they are both urban and urban, they show an undisguised and sometimes intense love of such natural object as trees, plants, birds, and country scenes in general. Then all of them exhibit an admiration of simplicity as against the sophistication culture of the court. Again, none of them shows any real intensity of feeling and rapturous spontaneity we have come to associate it with Elizabethan lyricist. Lastly, their idiom and diction reflects the flavor and aristocratic speech, fluent, though a little slipshod and unamenable to the dueling discipline of any formal education. The conversational flavor of the following line needs no emphasis. Now you have freely given me leave to love. What will you do? Crewe's line. Hark, reader, wilt be learned, I'th was Lawless, and I will thee, fellow, whoe'er thou be, that made this fine sing-song of me, thou art a rhyming sort, Suckling. The twin influence of Donne and Ben Jonson. The conversational note, which imports a kind of dramatic qualities into poetry, might have been due to Donne's influence. Donne himself was fond of imparting drama to lyrics. Witness such lines as the following: I wonder by my troth that thou and I did will be loved. But Donne's influence on the chevalier poets went further than this. His use of the metaphysical conceit prompted emulation. The chevalier poet sometimes directly imitated Donne's conceit. The following lines from Crewe's Upon a Riband are directly based on the Donne's The Funeral. This silken wreath circled in mine arm is but an emblem of that mysticious charm wherewith the magic of your beauties binds my captive soul. Lawless to Lucasta, Going Beyond the Seas, and Suckling's to Mistress Cecily Crofts, Echo Donne's The Ecstasies and a Valediction Forbidding Morning. In more general terms, Dunge gave a severe poet's the tendency of introspective self-analysis so conspicuously lacking in most courtiers, and the tendency of ratiocinative argumentation using example for from all branches of learning. Dunne was also respected by them for his exuberant fancy, of which some example may be found in their own works too. Like Dunne's poems, some of the Chevalier poems show a rare blend of passion and ratiocination. Some of the Dunnean kind of cynical realism also is to be found in these poems. But Dunne was not the only guiding spirit for the Chevalier poets. There was Ben Jonson too. Indeed, most of them felt proud of calling themselves son of Ben. For members of the tribe of Ben, the rare Ben Jonson was the first classical lyricist in English literature. He himself wrote under the influence of the Latin lyricist and the antiquity, particularly Catullus. Like all classicists, he set store by lucidity and general beauty of expression, chastened and chiseled imagination, and balance and proportion of design. The Chevalier poets were especially indebted for the clarity of expression to Ben Jonson. They disowned the turbidity of Dunne's poetic expression. Their control of emotion, felicity of phrase, and sophistication of tone were some other genuine qualities. Many of them wrote tributary verses to Ben Jonson as they did to Dunne. In fact, Dunne and Jonson both influenced the Chevalier poets in most equal proportions and mostly for the better. Geoffrey Walton observed in this connection in a noted comma, as the poetic master of these poets, Dunne and Jonson formed an almost ideal partnership, at once stimulating and disciplining, arousing exuberant feeling and ingenuous elaboration of the fancy, and exerting a dignified restraint and sensitivity literary tact. Critical evaluation. The Chevalier lyric does not by any means enjoy an inconsiderable position in the history of English literature. It is customary to compare the Chevalier poets with Elizabethan lyricists doing this. Swinburne put the former above the latter, comparing the growth of the drama and that of the lyric in England. He points out that the kind of drama which started with Marlowe at once reached its apex in Shakespeare and immediately suffered a steep decline in the Jacobean and Carolian period till it died with Sheridan. On the other hand, the lyric starting with Yeat and Surrey developed slowly, reached a high point in Elizabethan age, but went on rising still higher and reached its apex in the work of Chevalier poets, and started declining only after them. Most critics do not accept this placement of the Chevalier poet above the Elizabethan lyricist. The Chevalier have certainly more of polish and even ingenuity, but they lack of spontaneity and emotional intensity of the Elizabethans. The Oates notes world of Shakespearean song are not to be heard in their effort, even though they have quite a few attractive substitutes to offer. Let us now consider briefly the work of major Chevalier poets we have named above. Robert Herrick, 1591-1674. Herrick, by the consensus of critical opinion, enjoys the highest status among the Chevalier poets. This is the status which Douglas Bruce also gives him in English literature earlier 17th century. However, Geoffrey Walton, in his essay on the Chevalier poets in volume 2 of the Pelican Guide to English Literature, would place Crewe above him. Herrick was the only Chevalier who was not a courtier. He was the first of the son of Ben Jonson who came under his influence. Hardin Crease observed in a history of English literature, Hardin Crease, in a noted comma, he becomes Johnson's greatest disciple and actually realized a greatness in the field of classical lyric, superior of that of Johnson himself, in order to come closed. Along with Johnson, Herrick took for his model and inspiration the clear, objective, spirited, but perfectly ordered and lucidly worded poetry of the Latin poets like Ovid, Horace, Catullus, Martial, and the Greek poet Anacreon. Possibly in this Latin version, done by Henry Aston, he does not seem to have paid much attention to Elizabethan lyricists before him. But his first guide was Saint Ben, whose aid he invoked in his poem Prayer to Ben Jonson. Herrick was perfectly convinced of his immortality as a poet of, and therefore very assiduously he preserved each of every scrap of his writing. His only book, Herpreads on the Works Both Human and Divine of Robert Herrick, which appeared in 1648, contains about 1200 poems, few of which extended beyond 100 lines. Most of them are the occasional type or of the nature of epigrams. Herrick is a poet of moods and moments and is perhaps incapable and sustained poetic expression, but he is seldom frivolous, indulgent, and unsophisticated, as F. H. Moorman observed in inverted comma. He reveals lyrical power of the high order, fresh, passionate, and fastidiously exact, but at the same time meditative and observant. However, we have to agree with Geoffrey Walton that Herrick is a poet of charmingly fanciful but simple sensibility. His moods and themes have variety but no complexity. The true metaphysical manner is beyond him. He sings mostly of women, love, wine, and song, but he also exhibits a refreshing love for trees, plants, and flowers, and often looks at them as emblems of human presentiment, as for instance in divination by a daffodil. When a daffodil I see hanging down his head towards me, guess I am what I must be. First, I shall decline my head. Secondly, I shall be dead. Lastly, safely buried. Or again, see the last stanza of the two blossom. But you are lovely leaves where we may read how soon things have their end, thou never so brave. And after they have sown their pride, like you, awhile the guide into the grave. But Herrick was not one put protean moods and is equally dexterous in the expression of them all. Sherry Ripe to Julia and to Althea are some of his best known poems. He is indeed the delight of all anthologists. Thomas Crewe, 1598 to 1639. Whereas Herrick looked to Johnson alone, Crewe blend in his poetry the metaphysical manner of Donne and the classical spirit of Ben Jonson. His poems on Donne and Johnson express admirably his keen appreciation of his two guides. Johnson was to him the man greater than all men else, and Donne the poet worth all that went before. The Geoffrey Walton observed in inverted comma, the true influence of Donne and Johnson are fused in him by a considerable native talent. Inverted comma close. Hardin Crays observed in inverted comma, he borrowed from them to the extent in which a poet of his power cloud from Johnson the great lesson of classical polis, and from Donne a sense of exciting power of a figure. Inverted comma close. As an instance, see the following lines. I am a dial sand, still walking round. You are the compass and I never sound. Beyond your circle neither can I saw. Aught, but what first expressed is in you. From to Celia upon love's ubiquity. So thou, a virgin at a bride. to every grace the sea justified, a chaste polygamy and died, from Maria Wentworth. Crusoe's more of critical intelligence and sense of pattern than Herrick, but he suffers in imaginative power, which gets a substitute in a kind of courtly wit. Among his popular poems may be mentioned Upon a Ribbon Tied, about his army by a lady, a very delightful lyric in all lines, Ask Me No More, Where Job Besson, Vengeance in Past the Fading Rose. A famous song, and that very good didactic lyric, He That Loves a Rosy Cheek. Sir John Suckling, 1609-1642. It is customary to characterize Suckling as a both an irresponsible man and an irresponsible poet. Thus, says Lewis, in inverted comma, Sir John Suckling typifies the Chevaliers, their loyalty, dash, putlancy, frivolity, easy morals and wit, rich spendthrift, valiant, a gamester and a gallant and amateur of the drama who wrote for not unsuccessful play and a faithful admirer of Shakespeare. Suckling mocked at the pens Crewe took a polish his verse. He was himself an improviser on whose work is very unequal, but who writes with irresistibly swings. Harding Crease thinks such criticism to be unjustified. His verses, says this critic, show no evidence of carelessness, and his dramas are rather carefully wrought. On the personal side, also, the estimate is a little misleading. Since Suckling was a man who respected religion and wrote a treatise on the subject, Harding Crease is more correct than Lewis, who follows the traditional assessment of Suckling. Suckling, in his poetry, shows the twin influence of Johnson and Donne. His cynical observation and female capriciousness and inconstancy, and his hard introspective realism remind on one of Donne. His general attitude is well leavened with what Geoffrey Walton calls his uninhibited and boisterous cynicism and a good sense of horror. This attitude determines the spirit of his poetry. The controlling wit, Suckling a delicate sense of observation, is exemplified by the following lines from a ballad upon a wedding. Her feet beneath her petticoat, like little Mike, stole in and out, as if they feared at the light. His best known poem is the song from Aglaura, A-G-L-A-U-R-A. Why so pale and one fond lover? Which expresses a somewhat Tennyson sentiment. Richard Lawless, 1618-258. Lawless is the least important of the foursome and Chevalier poets named above. He was a very well-educated courtier and was even sent to prison for favoring the king actively in the civil war. It was in 1648 that, while in prison, he prepared for the press his volume entitled Lucasta, a poet's odes, sonnets, songs, etc., to which is owed Amarantha, a pastoral, 1649. Though his poems are full of freshness and exuberance, he lacks the fancy of Herrick, the force of Suckling, the police of Crewe. He saw, saying Harding Crease, in inverted comma, not so skillful and sustained as Crewe, perhaps not so forceful as Suckling, but has the greatness of having achieved a few immortal utterances. Inverted comma close. His Iliada Glove is the prettiest of the short pieces. thou snowy form with thy five tenements, tell thy white mistress here was one that called to pay his daily rents, but see a gathering flowers and herds is gone, and thou left wed to prude possession. His to Althea from prison has for the concluding stanza of the following famous lines: stone walls do not a prison make, nor iron bars a cage. Mind innocent and quit, take that for a hermitage. If I have freedom in my love, and in my soul I am free, angel alone that soar above, enjoy such liberty. The topic, Chivalry Poets, over.